There is a big program going to hit the national television. Else, whether you're satellite or broadcast, it doesn't matter. It's on the Sci-Fi Channel tomorrow night, December the 12th, 9 Eastern, 8 Central. Check your local listings to be sure. It's on the Sci-Fi Channel. It is another one of those. It's their third outstanding investigative documentary productions on major UFO events. You saw the one on Kecksburg most recently. Prior to that, there was one about Roswell. Tomorrow night, the title of the sci-fi documentary is UFO Invasion at Rendlesham. Now, many of you listening know about Rendlesham. We've done programs on it over the years. We're going to talk to some of the key people involved with that tonight, people featured in the Sci-Fi Channel documentary as well. In late December, it seems like it wasn't this long ago, but it was already 23 years ago. In late December 1980, in Rendlesham Forest, England, numerous U.S. military personnel witnessed what has come to be regarded as the most significant military UFO incident in the history of Great Britain. The servicemen who were posted at the RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge facilities, which together constitute one of the largest NATO bases in rural Suffolk, East Anglia, were on December 27th when they noticed unusual lights and activity near the base's back gate. It went on from there. It's a very complicated story. When you see this tomorrow night, you're going to see an achievement in documentary making, which I've seen it already. I had a preview copy, which I think surmounts one of the most difficult chores of any television producer, and that's to take a very complicated event of incidents, a sequence of events, if you will, and make them logical and handleable to the first-time viewer. They've done that extremely well. The program is hosted by Bryant Gumbel. Again, it's UFO Invasion at Rendlesham. First up tonight is a man who I have had the pleasure of having on the program a number of times over the years. He's well-known in the circles of ufology. He is Peter Robbins, who co-authored a very important book about this. And let's say hello to Peter right now. Welcome, Peter. Are you there? Can you hear me all right?
I am, Jeff. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. The book Left at Eastgate remains a minor classic, if not a major classic in the genre. It's written by you and Larry Warren, who will be joining us in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Since you've written the book, Peter, how has it held up under new evidence?
Well, very well, Jeff. We are, in fact, dealing with a case here that is seminal in UFO studies. For my money, it is the best all-round case that we have available to us as researchers. Almost every aspect of subspecialties that ufology encompasses are included in this case, whether or not it's physical evidence, military documentary evidence, civilian witnesses, credible military witnesses, physiological changes to soil, a history in the area. It is a story that absolutely obsessed me for a decade, and I must say I guess I kind of caught that from my co-author, who, as you know, is the real hero in this story. He is the man who broke this story wide open internationally at tremendous personal cost.
Well, he blew more than a whistle on this one.
He sure did. And it's, you know, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. And that was 20 years ago that Larry went forward, 3 years after he left the service with an honorable discharge. And although I also got my preview copy of the tape this afternoon from the nice folks at Sci-Fi, I'm not a fatalist, but I think I'm going to sit on my hands and wait till tomorrow night and watch it with everyone.
That takes a lot of self-control. you were clearly featured in it as a major source and handled yourself beautifully. I want to just comment on all of you folks at the Sci-Fi Channel who are listening now, you people who produced the documentary. You did just a magnificent job with, again, a very sophisticated and rather complicated series of events. Just so I salute you, and I hope everyone listening is able to watch this. I know it'll be repeated on the Sci-Fi Channel a number of times. Let's, with that, welcome your friend and colleague live from England now, where it's in the middle of the night, Larry Warren. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the program. Say something, Larry.
Hello, I'm here.
He's off
in
to
Liverpool.
He's off to a blazing start, probably. It's 3 a.m. in the UK.
Does that guy have a cup of coffee near him?
I do.
Thank God.
I do. You want one?
I've got one near me, too, but it's only 11 here.
Okay.
Oh, 11 here. Yes, good to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's been about 5 or 6 years since you were on last, I guess, something like that.
Well, we came on as guests when we first did the book, and you were very kind to us then, and God knows we needed some kindness at the time.
It was a difficult and bumpy issue. Larry, what was it about this whole thing that, I guess, in the beginning prompted you to stand up and say, hey, something really big time went on here, and I don't care who is offended by this, I'm going to tell it like I saw it. What was it that pushed you to do that? You could have just as easily stayed in the shadows.
Right. Anyone could that does this kind of, talks about any unpopular issue or... I think just having gone through it and then getting pretty righteously angry about how myself and a number of other folks that went through these events were treated in the aftermath. It's not so much seeing the phenomenon as real. I think most sane people know that there's something going on at this point. And I think at that time, what people have to understand, obviously books that were written and have been written since, and since ours, there's been other ones, and, you're going to get crucified one way or another, particularly back at that time.
Was it as bad as you expected it to be?
No, because I've never been confronted to my face by any of the noisy negatives like Stan Friedman, I think, aptly calls them. And, the UFO field has never been that friendly to witnesses, in my opinion.
Especially military witnesses.
No, it isn't. And I think the other witnesses to these events, which have been out now, like Mr. Halton, Jim Peniston, all the other folks, are, finding out that, you just simply can't say what you went through with somebody rewriting what you said or having their own agenda and fitting you into it. It's very frustrating, and yet it's important. I do it all over again. It's been basically the thing it's been 23 years of my life. It's been in the heads of everyone else. You can't walk away from this kind of thing when you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's what Peter said, hero before. I appreciate that, but in reality, I feel I did the right thing at the time. I think the witnesses coming forward, hopefully I did some helpful things as far as getting the information leading to the whole document coming out, the tape going public at that time, and getting other witnesses feeling that they had to say something about it. And, my version's never going to be what the guy next to me says or vice versa. This needs to be dealt with in a proper forum, and I'm really feeling that the sci-fi program that was produced by MPH Entertainment in California, from what I'm hearing, is the first step as far as a visual commentary on this, fair and balanced. It sounds like it's really been done.
You haven't seen it yet either?
No. Uh-huh. Not at all.
It is absolutely excellent.
Oh, that's great to know. It really is. And the public deserves to see it in the right way. I know Charles Holt and Jim Peniston. I live in England, obviously, and the BBC absolutely did a number on those two fellows back in, last year on another documentary of its kind, and it was absolutely, they were fine and good on it and righteous, but it was leading up to this Gulf War, and the BBC was very political in their... They used these two guys as military people, and look at these bad Americans. And it's awful, and thank God for Larry Lansman and Sci-Fi Channel for saying there was value in this case, and there is value, and always will be. And the people that get annoyed with this case and think it maybe steps on other things, it doesn't. It is just the one that you can go to court and win with, and that's just the simple facts.
I like that metaphor. You could. It's simple. And by the way, all the witnesses you mentioned come across marvelously in the program. each makes a very important contribution, especially Jim Peniston, whom I had not spoken to before and was not aware that he had such intimate involvement with this event or series of events. I mean, you all were just amazing to watch. I mean, this is a big case.
Boy, oh boy, you know, thank God, finally. When Pete and I, when I victimized Peter Robinson, got him to be my co-author, and it took like a decade or something, and marriage and our jobs or whatever went where it went. The best thing about it is that, and what people maybe didn't understand, is that we did not try to tell other witnesses' stories, even from what we knew. I've spoken to people like John Burroughs over the years and Charles Halt, a lot of things, but it was more for hopefully to open the gates for them to go forward and say, this is it.
Well, I think this is exactly what has been accomplished. You'll see it, all of you, tomorrow night on the Sci-Fi Channel. Be right back with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins after this. In New York, and we're talking about the big program tomorrow night on the Sci-Fi Channel, the Rendlesham Forest case 23 years ago. When I said earlier it's especially tough often on military eyewitnesses, not the least of which factors I was alluding to were the threats that they can get from their superiors and the government and so on and so forth. Were you under anything, when you got out, did you have to sign a non-disclosure form? Have you been threatened or hassled, Larry, in any way?
Well, well, when we were debriefed, we were, you know, in a veiled way, and
how veiled?
I don't know if I said it on this program, but it's something I've said for a good 20 years, is that there was at one point when we were debriefed, and this has been verified, is that one of these debriefers, one of these people, and it was not Air Force OSI with us at all. There was only three of them on our base, and they were drug interdiction officers. They had nothing to do with the subject. These people all descended on that base, and that I think that's been verified. But there was a kind of a phrase, bullets are cheap, and it's become kind of a catchphrase, but it was said nevertheless. You know, what would happen if we said anything? You know, not to do that. And, you know, of course, the first thing I did is ran and called my mother on a public phone on the base, and I was with Greg Batrum, who was involved in a earlier part of the incident, and I was, you know, was intercepted. I mean, all calls from the base are intercepted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're 19 and you're, you know, I was predisposed. I mean, I believe the subject existed. I just didn't know to what level it existed and how frightened the people that control it are and paranoid. Boy, the Air Force had nothing to do with that end of it, I can tell you. They were on the sidelines, and Charles Halt said that. In the aftermath, they were the Air Force was on the sidelines. I wasn't debriefed by Air Force. And there was that, and then as you know, you get out and you tell friends, you're having a beer, and they laugh at you. And, of course, 23 years later, they go, oh, geez, I had no idea how much was in this.
Excuse me, Larry.
Yeah.
If the Air Force didn't debrief you, who were these people?
Well, there were people that identified themselves as being from the Navy, and we're in Malcolm Ziegler's office, a major. The only thing I signed was about five or six documents, and on the desk, the law enforcement desk, that basically were pre-typed statements that said that I was off duty, and I know the other fellow signed them too, that we were off duty and we saw just unknown lights in the trees, which the Air Force tried to use later on in some of the FOIA requests as far as their PAT statement. But
was this Office of Naval Intelligence?
Yeah, and also was Armed Forces Security Services, which were two plainclothes fellas, and they were there, and those are the guys that debriefed us, and they were there within hours.
Peter Robbins, it's interesting how often the Navy comes up in issues of outer space, of ET reports, of abduction reports. The ONI seems to be a many-tentacled arm of inquiry and certainly suppression of evidence.
I think that that is something that began at the dawn of the end of World War II. Let's remember that the original plan to reorganize the services that was accepted by Truman and handed over to James Forrestal to rebuild the old War Department into the Department of Defense was the Navy's plan. Forrestal was a former Secretary of Navy. The Navy has always been involved at the highest levels of intelligence, and I think there's something of a natural cover there for most of us regular, normal, trusting citizens that, you know, the sailors that we see on ships are one of the most romanticized areas of the military, and it's hard to think of them spying. But indeed, that's a fact, and as far as we know, John Kennedy was not just a PT boat skipper. He was naval intelligence as well.
The issue of the space probe Clementine and its mapping of the moon, especially the backside of the moon, was a Navy operation.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, they're not just in ships anymore, as they say.
I was surprised with that. You know, I mean, if you, when you go through this kind of thing, and I'll tell you, it's different than... I mean, you're amazed. I mean, you're like, this stuff is real, and now they're going to start doing the heavies. But mm-hmm. you had asked about what has been done to me, and I think, as you've seen in this program, Jim Peniston is just another example of, I won't even say, the audience will see it in this program, what he went through. I mean, we were all put through, I hate speaking for other people, because I have no right to, and they lived it, and they have to say it. But, really, it gets more into human rights and a violation of human rights. We're serving our country. We saw something that they don't want, that isn't supposed to be there, whatever that is, I don't know. But it wasn't built in Detroit, and there was a life form associated with it. Now, I have taken that position. Not a popular position. I think a lot of people worry about ridicule, and rightly so, for saying that these things are piloted by something. And that there's an intelligence behind it. They're not nuts and bolts, things just flying that build themselves. And
right.
There's something superior to us doing it, which mm-hmm. is, I think, a big factor in the fear here. But these things were on that base for over 3 days, which I've been saying for years. A lot of people said I made up the third day or the fictitious third day. You'd have to be completely insane to want to inject yourself into this thing because it's been no pleasure. Mm-hmm. But now, of course, there were 3 days, so I mean, it's one. I don't have to be right, but it's nice every now and then to have things verified. But I've had my passport suspended by the United States government in 95. It took Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, to get it back for speaking about sensitive defense issues on foreign soil. And that's when I started to say, look, this government over here in Britain has always weaseled their way out of any responsibility with this by saying, well, if there was a cover-up, and I have to say our good friend...
Right, let me hold, Larry, hold on right there. We have to pause. We'll come back, pick that thread up in just a couple minutes with Larry Warren. Okay, and we're back. December 1980, Rendlesham Forest, England. You all see this tomorrow night in the documentary on the Sci-Fi Channel. Check your local listings for time. Don't miss it. This is a real good one, and I was very impressed with the way Bryant Gumbel handled himself in this Peter Robbins and the other two documentaries as well, all three of which he has hosted. He gave complete respect. There was nothing in his voice that we were used to hearing over the decades that degrades the phenomenon. I mean, he was right there.
You know, it's fascinating, Jeff, that you bring that up. Things change one person at a time, I think, in life more often than all at once. And Bryant seems to be a good example of a product of the corporate world that signed on to an initial project, obviously found it interesting enough, you know, was paid to do his work, but came back, I'm sure, at some risk of ridicule, and is doing a third one. Common sense suggests that he has simply gotten quite interested in it. And it begs a larger question, which is something we're seeing happen with this corporation that is, well, a subsidy of which is the Sci-Fi Channel, where executives are saying, this push toward better UFO documentary programming is capturing an audience share. People are responding. Advertisers are advertising. And we take this more seriously now. I remember hearing last year in as the build-up was coming toward the showing of Taken, which they had really risked their shirt on, the president of the Sci-Fi Channel saying, although we are presenting this as a fictional story, we, meaning we, some of the people at the executive level, among others, are convinced that such things are genuinely happening, and so is Mr. Spielberg. Absolutely fascinating. So good programming, a little corporate responsibility here moving forward, and nobody more so than the Sci-Fi Channel. And as Larry mentioned, Larry Landsman, the head of special projects, who's had an awful lot to do with spearheading this development, is to be congratulated.
Oh, indeed.
Very exciting, very exciting.
So rather than a television network which, I don't want to use the word exploits, but uses a phenomenon to build itself a career, the Sci-Fi Channel, to its everlasting credit, and Larry Landsman, have forged ahead now and are taking a noble position of leadership in the field to demand reality and accountability. And I think your point about Bryant is exactly on the money. I'm quite sure the man, at the very least, goes home at night now thinking that something very big is going on, probably the biggest story of his journalistic career, all in all, if the whole thing could be gathered together. And I think we have a real important accomplishment thanks to the Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, I agree. And as we know, it's expanding. It's been more than a year since they have been working with Leon Podesta's agency in Washington.
Right.
And
tell our listeners who Leon is.
He is the former chief of staff of the Clinton White House, who, like many politicos at that level of the game, when they leave the dominant office, go into the business of lobbying. And he and his brother, as I understand it, have a very successful firm, which the Sci-Fi Channel has been consulting with and working with.
Mm-hmm.
They are also now a member of a coalition involved in securing documents from NASA. That they feel NASA is withholding relative to the UFO reality.
And that's Leslie Kane, who has put her name on the dotted line, and salutes to you, Leslie.
Boy, I'll say. Now, that is one heck of a journalist and one terrific lady.
Yep. Well, we'll watch that, and I'll be here to help in any way I can all the way through this thing. And, you know, it's way past time. The whole idea, Larry Warren, that our government, for whatever reason, national security, doesn't consider us or treat us to be competent enough to have the truth. They're playing their little game of, I've got my little surprise here, and you're not going to get it because you don't deserve it, and you're not smart enough. It's such an insult to common sense that, I don't know, I think the public is more than ready for almost anything that can be thrown at it.
I think I agree with you, especially since 2 years ago. I mean, who'd be surprised with anything nowadays? But I was really proud to be part of this thing. But the Disclosure Project, back in May of 2001,
mm-hmm.
in Washington, I was part of that panel, and I was living over here at the time, and I went over. Stephen Greer brought us over, and all I can say about that guy is his word is good, and I know a lot of people have, you know, gets mud thrown or whatever, but his word is good, and he really put a lot of effort into that thing. And if I may just say for a minute, at the NPC, when we did that press conference,
mm-hmm.
talking about Washington, and there were people that make me look like a cupcake. There were SAC-based commanders, and these were all legitimate officers, and head of the FAA Eastern Division, John Callahan. I mean, it was madness. I couldn't believe some of the credentials these people had. And we had more press in attendance at the NPC than Ronald Reagan did as an acting president. Not one of the news camera crews left in 4.5 hours. Not one reported it. We had NSA, CIA, mm-hmm. all openly there, wanting mm-hmm. to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Standing ovation at the end, but when the live web link went up at 9 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
which was a subsidiary of CNN that ran that, it was knocked down, and it was knocked down intentionally in the D.C. area, and that isn't a UFO rumor. That actually came from the company. So the 500,000 people waiting to log on to this thing in the first hour couldn't see a darn thing. And then we spent a week lobbying, you know, and I'll tell you, I spoke to a lot of senators and congressmen and their staffs, and I was in the Air Force group of guys. We all hung together, and every one of these people, in fact, including John McCain, Ted Kennedy, you know, all the different parties, the whole thing, they were totally, totally interested in the subject and knew that it was being suppressed.
Sure.
But you could not find one person. They said to us, they go, well, you want congressional hearings. What committee does it go on, science or military? What guys are you going to get to risk their careers to sign on to that and sponsor it? And we're only here for 4 years usually, so who's going to risk that? Fascinating.
Yeah, all right, indeed.
But we got suppressed. We really did. That thing, they really suppressed it.
Sure, I remember. Oh, yeah. Okay, let me remind all of you, when you go to Rents.com, look on the right-hand side for the Rents.com store. The good people there, Randy and others, have put together four Rendlesham Forest products right on the homepage of the store for tonight's program, especially. Two books left at Eastgate by my guests, Larry Warren and Peter Robbins, and UFO Crash Landings by Jenny Randles. There's one new DVD, Left at Eastgate, an update 2003, and the Left at Eastgate CD-ROM, all there for you at the UFO store. Call the Rents.com store on my website. Okay, we will be back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to get into more of the specifics of what happened at Rendlesham Forest 23 years ago in just a few minutes. Of Left at Eastgate. You get an autographed copy of that. Again, just click on the term. You'll see it right below Larry's name in the guest box, Left at Eastgate. Take you right to the Rents.com store. Okay, now, one thing I was interested in noting in the documentary was it was cold then. It was not. It was right at freezing. You guys weren't tromping out there in 40 or 50 degree weather. It was a cold night the first night.
Well, the first night I wasn't involved in that, but
right.
it was cold, I guess, for a lot of the southern guys. But having grown up in New York State,
yeah,
to me, it was pretty mild. So
southern
I think
it was cold.
It was cold. Yeah, it was December.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us. Let's go ahead and build the story about Larry Warren and what happened to you. You've done this a thousand times, but it's always interesting to our newcomers. And even,
yeah,
you know, folks forget that, you know, there's a 50% memory loss overnight and about 95% by the end of a week, so.
Oh, my God.
It's that much.
And after 40, it's just all downhill.
It's starting over again. It's called reboot time.
Who are you?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, basically, you know, again, I was a new security policeman, and I was assigned to my shift, which was D flight, and we had been on we worked six on, three off. I had my PRP, which meant I could work around the nuclear weapons that we didn't have, and be on the flight line. And you know, and the first 2 weeks there was on the job training. And for years they said, you know, certain elements have said, well, he couldn't have been involved because you don't get on flight for like 20 weeks or some crazy thing. And all I say now is people will see Ed Kabanasak, who was involved in the first night. Eddie was an airman first class like me,
yeah,
and was a new airman and got to the base a week after I did. He was in the rotation after me in,
yeah,
Texas for training. So that goes out the window again, too.
Yeah.
Away from that, I had no idea that there had been two previous evenings of activity. And, of course, we know the first night was Jim Peniston and Burroughs and Kibanisak and others' involvement. The second night, there was airborne objects seen, apparently. And third night, I was on my post. It was a remote post, perimeter post 18, which was at the end of the Bentwaters flight line. And we were in an alert condition. I know people have tried to say we weren't, which takes the thing down a notch. We were in alert, and I have pictures that prove it.
After two nights of activity, how could you not be in an alert position?
I know. Well, we were, and because the morning of my involvement on the base, I'd been off the base, I took a picture of the main gate, and it's in the book, but it's in, and that was literally taken that morning with a 110 camera.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing it would show was alert condition or normal, and we were in alert condition. So,
what was your post like? Were you in a vehicle, in a small building, in a tower? Tell our listeners what you were actually stationed at.
Yeah, it was a bunch of sandbags with netting over it. It was really very uncomfortable and cold. And you would
know. You're from New York. Come on.
Yeah, we're tough. So they threw me in there, and you have your Motorola radio. Now, again, I was rather new. We've had our incoming training over the week because each base has its own security. It's all OJT in the Air Force, on-the-job training.
By the way, excuse me, you said something that might have passed by our listeners too quickly. We were not supposed to, by international agreement, have any nuclear weapons in the UK. That
right.
base had a lot of them. Were you told in no uncertain terms that there were nukes on the base?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I was at McGuire Air Force Base flying over to Bentwaters, I would have gone over to Mildenhall. This was on November 29th, 80. I was in the men's room, and there were, you know, everything happens in a men's room for some reason. Just ask George Michael. But I was in the men's room. This is different, though. Bad joke. And there was a guy, Rick Bertolino, who was going to my base, and there was a captain that happened to be in the bathroom. And it was the stupidest thing. You know, I had big mouth and put my foot in it, and I said, oh, you're going to Bentwaters? I said, do they have nukes there? And the whole bathroom, I tell you, about 20 people, and they just went silent. So that was my first kind of, you know, boy, mm-hmm. I can't keep a secret. So off I went,
mm-hmm.
and we did. We had tactical nuclear weapons that would have been not deployed by A-10 tank busters, which were our weapon, flying in, taking them out, flying them in, taking them out.
Could have been several hundred weapons that we don't know, at least.
Oh, there was quite a bit, and I don't know the exact number, but we were a first-strike option for the Soviets also. I mean, they would have hit us before London, obviously.
Right.
That's the reality we lived with at that time.
And they probably knew they were there as well.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, the British government knew it, and the anti-nuclear loonies, they used to, the CND people, which, I mean, it's honorable, but boy, they used to tie themselves naked to the fences at Greenham Common and do all these things, and our base was a diversion because Greenham Common didn't have the arsenal that we did.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd rather have the you know, the lunatics on the fence there than at Bentwaters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a vocal, yeah. So Bentwaters, in fact, funny enough, I've angered all the CND people now, but that's just how they looked at it. And anyway, on my post, I was on this remote post, and I was new, and I started to hear all these transmissions about the lights are back, and that would have come from the Speakeds Tower. It's 80 feet tall. And it's in the weapon storage area on Bentwaters, and you could see out toward Rendlesham Forest, toward Woodbridge Bay. So they were seeing something. I was curious. I looked. There was a part where some deer jumped our fences at that time. They were low, very silly fences, very low on the base, and ran across the flight line, these jack deer. And I just felt very strange. Before long, I got a radio call, Airman Warren, you know, deactivate your post. And I was picked up by Lieutenant Bruce England, Adrian Bastinza, who was a sergeant, who was driving, and there were two other personnel in the back of this vehicle that were in my rank, and we went off to the motor pool. So my post was, I could leave it, because it was, again, only manned during alert. We went to get light-alls, which are devices that light up aircraft, you know, on the tarmac when they're being refueled.
Yeah.
Didn't know anything about them. They had one guy in the motor pool trying to hook them up. There was a problem with the gauges, and there was some senior people that were very nervous and acting you know, kind of in hindsight, very strange. There were radio transmissions. People were trying to find, locate the base CO, which is the commanding officer, which is Gordon Williams, and would have been. And we moved on. We stopped at the Bentwaters main gate, which led to the civilian area, and picked up a few other vehicles, a law enforcement car, and we went sped off towards the east end of Woodbridge Base. And I swear, I remember talking to the fellas in the back of this truck and the pickup truck we were in, and we were saying, you know, this must be an exercise and, you know, war games and all, but we still had our weapons. And we got to the east end of Woodbridge Base. There was a roadblock there. There was a white Ford Cortina civilian car. I think this woman has come forward over the years, and there was a little girl asleep on the seat. I could look down right into it. And they told her they wouldn't hold her up. Sometimes people would use the back gate, you know, dependents to get onto the bay. She was British, though, I remember. And they said there was unexploded ordnance or something to do with that. We moved through that, and why our book is called Left at East Gate, it was basically the last sane thing I heard, is we came down past East Gate Road. There was another roadblock, law enforcement car. And our driver, Bruce England, said, where are we supposed to go? And the guy said, turn left after East Gate. And so we turned on a track into the forest.
How many vehicles?
With us at that time, there were probably three at that point with personnel and two light alls in tow.
Okay, now you move into the forest. What kind of a road? Old Macadam Road, tarmac?
It was an old dirt road, a logger's track. Yeah, it was we didn't know this forest was called Rendlesham Forest at all. That's why the thing was called the Bentwaters Incidents for years, because, you know, that was what we were familiar with.
Sure.
And we moved off into the forest, and it was, I will say, in hindsight, you know, it's a long time ago, but there was something strange. But being new, you know, I thought maybe this is what they do when you know, security police all the time ride off into the woods. I didn't know.
Okay. Hold on, Larry. We're coming up on a break here. Radio chatter, I guess, while you're in the truck, you're hearing it. Is there a lot of chatter?
Oh, yeah, an awful lot. And, again, the dominant thing was they were trying to locate the base CO, and that stands out. And they're trying to get some senior people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just a lot of concern, and it was a lot of coded things that I wasn't familiar with yet, you know, coded communications, and I just wasn't that up on the radio chatter yet.
All right, very good. Peter, this forest, give us a 45-second description of the forest. We'll see it all in the production tomorrow night on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, I wish I could say it's a romantic, beautiful, pastoral English forest that dates back to King Arthur. It doesn't. It is a forest that was created probably less than 100 years ago for logging purposes.
Right.
And at the same time, it is a highly evocative place to be, and a place that has another side story going on in terms of the quote-unquote freak storm that you're aware of that occurred in 1986.
Yeah, okay, true. Now, when you see this forest tomorrow night, you'll notice that the trees do seem to be rather artificially lined up. There are almost rows of them, and that does speak to a commercial enterprise of logging. Okay, hold on. We'll pause and come right back with Peter Robbins and Larry Warren. Larry Warren, the authors of Left at Eastgate, which you can get at Rents.com store. Look on the homepage there. Just click right below Larry Warren's name and guess, and you'll go right to the page. Be back in just a couple minutes. Okay, glad you're along. We are back in business. Let's hitch them up and pull them on out here, and we're going to some interesting territory in Rendlesham Forest this hour. Peter Robbins, you've been there a number of times, walking through it, looking around. Not a lot of visual things left of 23 years ago, of course. But what's your feeling when you walk through that place? Is it easy for you, having written the book and spent so much time with Larry, to kind of transport yourself back? What it must have been like, those December evenings, those three nights?
It's a great question. I've done it repeatedly over the years, day and night, winter and summer. I've actually lost count of how many times I've been back to that field that is marked on those English survey maps as Capel Green. It's very easy, knowing the story, to feel some of what you imagine went down that night, and it is a particularly memorable spot to visit after dark. You know the feeling that you get when you visit a place that is very pastoral, low-key, peaceful, mm-hmm. but you know something happened there that transformed lives. I'm tempted to say a battlefield, but there is some worthy analogy there. It's somewhat solemn to me now. I mean, we've had good times out there, brought friends, run into people who have turned it into something of a visiting destination, and had the fun of, you know, having them recognize us.
Interesting.
But the forest itself is it's a very unnerving place in some respects. It's also a place I've grown to love. I consider that part of England close to a second home for me, and boy, having read the book, you know that my first trip there was unbelievably unnerving, and I swore to myself I'd never come within 50 miles of the place again, but we were lucky to develop some phenomenal friendships there, and, you know, good friends are good friends, and they're irreplaceable, and I go back whenever I can.
Here's a little note. We had hoped to spend a little time with former Lieutenant Colonel, now retired, Charlie Hull tonight, but he was not able to be here. He is prominently featured in the documentary, which will be seen on the Sci-Fi Channel tomorrow night. But a little story here. Larry, I don't think you even know this.
Probably not.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I think about the time you guys were on, but not too far after that, someone called me who was familiar with a woman, a former Air Force, I don't know what her rank was. She was in the Air Force. She knew Halt and was living or stationed there at that time. I'm a little shady on the details, but cut the long story short, Charles Halt took her out there and I guess a couple of other people a night or two later, with night vision equipment or infrared equipment, and she was able to look through this this gear that he had with him, and he showed her the three indentations on the ground, which were still, I don't want to say glowing, but they were clearly visible with this night vision gear as having been made. There were three of them. And up in the trees, there were some broken branches on some of the trees up at the top, which also evidenced some glowing or reaction to the night vision gear. And she was on this program and was very courageous, and that was an interesting aspect of the story I had not heard before.
Right. I didn't know about that lady, but I do know Steve LaPlume, who even 2 weeks or a week after the initial events, a lot of the senior people on the base, they had said the lights were back again. And they went all running out into the forest and cars and things. And so, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like, let's go waste our time. There's something, you know, heavy going on.
No, not at all. All right, if you pick up the narrative on that third night with you and your involvement, that'd be great.
Yeah, basically, we got out into the forest, and we had to maintain radio silence. Within a few different groups of, there were a number of people moving in different spots of this forest, and you could see through the trees. It was the Corsican pines, so most of the branches start up high, so you basically have all these sticks to, you know, rather thin trees to look through, and you could see a good 100 yards through them.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved through. Long story short, there was a lot of activity. There was one point on the radios you could hear avoid the hot spots, which, you know, you would think of a forest fire or something. Which I assume must have been some areas where they're having interest on the Geiger counter.
Avoid the hot spots. So that was a warning put out to anyone who was in the forest.
Yeah, well, I think it was a certain group of folks talking to another group of folks in a certain area. It wasn't necessarily for us.
Okay. By the way, we know now there were two apparent landing locations, not just one, which is made amply clear in the documentary.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the as important as the first one is, and by God it is, with Peniston and those folks, and that's where the indentations and pod marks are, and the break in the canopy of the trees, which,
right,
you know, certainly was there. Capel Green is where we ended up on my night, and what was there, I will tell you, and I'll take to the grave, is that there were... What I saw was filmed, and it was. And where that film is, I don't know. But it exists. And there were pictures taken, and pictures did survive of this. They weren't all fogged and things because they just simply weren't. Basically, in the field, the first thing we noticed and I noticed was, number one, there was this foggy thing that was lit up on the ground. It was like a patch of ground fog all lit up. And off to
this is in the field adjacent to the trees.
Adjacent to the forest. It would have been, you get through the forest, and at the very end was this this field, this right. farmer's field. Right. And it was all grass at that time.
And the farmer's house was on the other side of the field.
It sure was. And the light was on the second floor. And
okay.
There was a dog barking. And I'm certain that the people that lived there witnessed this. They would have had to have. It was basically in their backyard. And there were a couple cows walking around at one point. I don't remember them after a certain time. Like Sergeant Bastinza said, it gave a sense of reality to the events for some reason. And in the field was this object. Now, I want to, this mist, it was about a foot in height. It was a part of the ground, though. It wasn't floating and all this. And in the, off to my right was a film unit. There were people with cameras that were filming it, and they were there. There were numerous personnel in the field, and they were at different points of this field. Off to the left would have been the Orford Lighthouse. Between the house and this location would have been Orford Lighthouse. Now, contrary to what the debunkers try and all this, and how insulting, isn't it, really?
No, you know, Larry, I didn't want to go there. Let's not even waste time on that because it's just crap. Just
yeah,
forget it.
Thank you. It's your show. You can say that word.
Forget
great.
The lighthouse.
Because it is crap. And south of where that lighthouse exists, a red light appeared,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't see the lighthouse anyway. So the red light appeared over the trees in the direction of the North Sea. It was an amber-red color. It moved in very quick in a downward arc somehow over this field. It stopped within, I don't know distance now, but I mean 75, 100 feet of where I was standing on a small rise. Sergeant Bastinza said to me at some point, this is just like what happened to me in Alaska. I thought he said he corrected that a couple years later in an interview. He said in California, I wish he'd talk about things more. And
okay, let me get this straight. Out in the middle of the field is something on the ground.
Yes.
There's something there.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of foggy mist around that something.
Well, that thing was, it was a translucent kind of, it had definition. It was about 50 foot in diameter, and it was about a foot in height. It was green and yellow misty thing, and you could see through it. You could see the ground under it, but it had form to it.
Okay, but are we talking a large circular mass?
More? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're almost describing a landing pad of some kind.
Well,
50 foot in diameter, roundish, translucent, slightly greenish thing on the on the ground or very close to the ground?
It was on the ground.
On the ground.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then comes the red light from above.
Yeah. It came in. It did a downward arc. It sat 20 feet in the air.
Over this other item?
I'm sorry?
Over this other item that's on the ground above
it? Dead center of it. Dead center, 20 feet in the air instantly. It was there, I don't know how long, I mean, a few seconds, and, I mean, you're just kind of in awe. So I can see this to this day, but, I mean, describing it does not do justice. Then there was what I've always said was an explosion, but this explosion was soundless, and it was it was a controlled kind of dispersal of light that was very, very bright. Now, on that tape Charles Holt made, you can hear, here comes the red lights coming in, and, of course, I was on record before that tape came out. But that red light coming in is the beginning of this event.
Okay, all right.
Through the trees.
Let's hold it right there. We come back. I want to ask Larry Warren to describe a little bit more about the explosion, the soundless explosion. What was it that exploded? Was it the red light or was it the item on the ground? We're going to get to all this in just a minute now. So you've got this field, and you'll see it tomorrow night on the Sci-Fi Channel. Don't miss this. This thing is fascinating. You can see the field. You'll see the farmer's house on the other side of the field. And so this red light comes in and parks itself about 20 feet above this translucent greenish object, round, sitting on the ground about a foot thick, right above it, right in the dead center above it. And then Well, we'll find out then next with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. Okay, let's rejoin our guests, Peter Robbins and Larry Warren, the authors of Left at East Gate. And do click on that just beneath Larry's name at Rents.com. Take a look. Okay, Larry, go ahead.
Mark Weld, Welder's Torch, that kind of thing. It was just extremely bright, multicolors. And see, this is there's a point where that happens, and then there's this a structured, what I think is a structured object in its place. It was that instant. But from that event, I had burns to the retinas of my eyes that are documented, that were documented at that time. There was, I have to say, even before this, the movement was at half speed in that field. It felt to me things were slowed down a little bit. Physiologically, you know, your movements and your mental agility, that kind of thing.
Did you feel anything physically that you were moving? Or was this just a sense that you were moving more slowly?
No, it felt artificial. Even as the before even that event happened in the forest, just things felt unnatural and strange.
Okay, just for the heck of it, please go back through that explosion one more time. I want to hear that again.
Yeah, this yellowish-green translucent object on the ground, this 50-foot, approximately 50-foot in diameter,
yeah.
Fog, the head definition was there. To the right of it, way out toward the North Sea, a red light appeared. It was an amber-red. It moved in quite rapidly over the field,
yeah.
And sat dead center about 20 feet in the air over this object, this mist on the ground. And mm-hmm. as soon as you registered that, this explosion happened kind of in a pyramid shape. It's hard to describe it, but and there was that phenomena happen, and then there's a gap, and then there's some this structured thing in its place, which was a triangular object, and it was not black and glass-like like they described on the first night. It was somewhat bigger. It was a multicolored rainbow effect on it. It had a very rough surface, and it had three delta appendages that came away from it, and it went to a rounded point on top. And there was blue lights at the base, cobalt blue. I don't know if there was landing gear or not. It was very low to the ground. It looked dirty, and it would distort on you. So if you looked on it sideways, and you know, people say, how could you stand there and not run? Well, some people did, back off. And I have to say, in the area when we started to disperse, John Burroughs was there in civilian clothes, who had gone through the first night. And you hear on Halt's tape, Airman Burroughs wishes to rendezvous with you at your location. You hear Charles Halt say back, tell him negative at this time. Well, tell him when he can come out here. And I've talked to John about that, and he literally was trying to get out into this forest because he knew this phenomena, as he told me directly, was going to return. And apparently he kept going out there for weeks. So
there's all of a sudden there's an object there.
Yeah.
Sitting
yeah,
pretty
was.
Much right in the center of what was that round thing
dead
on
center.
The ground.
Dead
okay.
center.
Big as an automobile?
No, it was about, I don't know, roughly 30 feet at the base and the side facing me up to 15 feet probably high. And
oh, this is a big piece of equipment.
Yeah, yeah. It would never have fit in the trees, ever. So this is where the confusion comes. This is a totally different phenomenon.
So there's an explosion, a pop with a lot of little colored objects moving away
right.
from the center, and in its place appears this thing.
Exactly, and it basically, I don't know if that's how it went down, but that's how my
okay.
mind's on.
All right,
so
all right. Are you hearing anything from the guys around you? Like, oh.
No, it seemed like a vacuum, but I will say there was no heat or effect that was noticeable, and there was no sound, and everything seemed like a vacuum. But I will say there were certain people involved in this thing that, and probably because of the previous night, that were trying to document this thing that
yeah.
did keep presence in mind.
Yeah.
And there is a film record of this. I don't know if that survived, but I'm sure it did, of everything that went down. I mean, I didn't just make this up. I mean, because it does isolate you talking about this thing, but it is the crux of the whole thing. A simple little UFO sighting, that's no big deal, they can write off, but there's some real heavy elements to this thing that they're still sitting on. And I can't pretend to know why, other than something very important happened there in 1980, and it was more than I know, and maybe some of the other, a lot of the other witnesses know. And this object was there, had no windows. I know Jim Peniston described symbols on the objects they saw. The object they saw, this, I didn't see anything like that.
No, it was a different object. We want to make that clear. It
was very different.
Jim saw something two nights earlier.
Two nights earlier that was within the trees, and it was much smaller.
Yeah.
This was not, and it would not have fit within the pine forest at all.
And we want to mention also that Jim Peniston walked up to it and put his hand on the object in the forest. That you will see reenacted in the
I'll tell you something else that happened that John Burroughs, who isn't on this documentary, you know, he's kind of angry with this thing over the years or whatever, you know, and I hope they all get to a point in their lives where they can kind of be a little more comfortable with it, is that another object appeared in this parking area, and he literally grabbed onto it, and it moved 10 meters with him holding onto it.
And, I've never heard that before.
Well, no one has, but he told me that in Los Angeles, and he was very upset about it. But these guys have not had a voice, and they need to have a voice, and hopefully, they'll feel more ready to do that now.
Okay, all right. Maybe we'll have a Rendlesham documentary part two if these guys see it and want to talk.
Well, they're looking to do that, and I'm hoping the response and people all tune in and get really righteously angry about it and start looking for answers.
Start demanding answers. Okay. We'll take a break and come right back with Peter Robbins and Larry Warren. Get back to Larry. Peter Robbins, this is high drama. This is about as exciting as it gets.
It really is, and I must say it has held my attention for about 15 years now. There is no story quite like it in terms of the human depth, the potential contributions it can make to our understanding of this unknown that faces us.
Multiple unknowns.
Yes, exactly. And I think just in drama hits the nail on the head. Jeff, as you know, it is one of the most remarkable stories. And I say that with all respect to the word. It is a 100% true account. And it still gives me the chills. It's one of the reasons why I am glad to hear Larry restating some of this material for many folks who are not familiar with it. And I have to say, hearing it for the umpteenth time, I never tire of it. It is phenomenal, and I've done the background work to document the truth of Larry's allegations, and it is the way it happened.
Well, he's got other witnesses with him as well. I hope those people come forward. Okay, Larry Warren, 30 feet across approximately, 15 feet tall.
Right.
Again, it's just kind of a dark, dirty metal color. It's dark out there. Are there any lights on?
No, they couldn't get the lights to work, and they couldn't have gotten them out into the field the way the terrain was. I think a lot of there was a number of different phenomena seen, like Charles Holt has said over the years, a number of different situations involving a number of different people at different times in the forest. I have no doubt in my mind this is the night Charles Holt made his the audio tape of this, these events, which I'm sure they play on this program. I hope they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's historic. I mean, that thing, I mean, it's simply a lieutenant colonel's, you know, documenting the stuff that the government says doesn't exist. You know, I mean,
he's a deputy base commander. Come on, he's got nukes under his control. And
I mean, that's major stuff, and it should be treated as such. But anyway, with me, and let me just cut to the chase real quick.
I need to know a couple things. How many men approximately are there seeing this thing, approximately?
Oh, a good 30. I mean, there were British police from the town of Woodbridge that were out there. You can hear them pull up in the forest on Holt's tape that they denied.
Okay.
All right,
go ahead. I just want to be sure we understand.
Yeah,
a lot of folks there.
Yeah, one of them was taking pictures. Then there were civilians that tried to get out to the forest that were had cameras confiscated from by law enforcement police, security police.
Okay.
And there's just a... Are you there?
Oh, yeah.
There were a ton of... there was just a lot of different people that this affected at different moments.
Okay, this object is sitting in the field now. What happens next?
Well, the next thing that happened, because I think it's more interesting what happened after, but there... The big problem with this certain people have is that I say, and I know others say kind of quietly, that there was a life form seen, and there was, and it was a translucent thing that came around the side of my blind side of this object. It had, there were like three like ghost things that had clothing of some kind that were rather small in stature.
Were they walking?
No, you see, that's where it gets bad. It was kind of in the air, you know.
They were kind of floating.
They were.
And they came around.
Yeah.
They came around the craft. You didn't see them come out of a door.
No. Okay. No, it was kind of ghostly, really.
Okay.
And it was just there. A lot of this unfolded, and mind you, we were not. I certainly was not like feeling like I am right now. It was kind of dreamlike, and this is where people say, well, this is mind control stuff, is what they did to kind of detract from the real events and all that stuff. But frankly, I'd like to know how they did that. But and this was documented, and then there were senior people that arrived on site, and I know there's a point of contention of who they were. And, you know, wouldn't it make sense to anyone that our wing commander of the base would be involved in this instead of just standing back? And, you know, I've never tried to hurt anyone, you know, by involving them in this or de-evolving them in it. But, you know, as far as I knew Gordon Williams, who was our wing commander. I was familiar with him more than I was Colonel Holt. That was later with Colonel Holt.
Mm-hmm.
And because he used to hang out with the security police. And he was there and he was present. And,
you saw him at that field?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
And I've always said this, you know, listen, if I've done defrauded anyone or done anything wrong with this, you know, I've never been sued for it. And, you know, there you go.
Okay.
But the bottom line is there were senior people, and he wasn't the only one.
Okay.
And he was close to this phenomena. I've never said there was communication between aliens and Gordon Williams or anything. That's, again, the myth-making that goes on in ufology, unfortunately. And but if there were, he was close enough. But I will say that there were, you know, people say, well, there couldn't have been. Jim Peniston had communication with that phenomena. He it spoke to him through that craft when he touched it. Now, I hope they deal with that in the show, but it said they were from the future. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, they said, we are you, you know, we're from the, you know, it's 500,000 years in the future. And I hope they deal with this, you know, because a lot of people are really uncomfortable or frightened to say that they've interacted with this phenomenon or been
It does tend to push it over the edge for the lot of average folks.
Yeah, it does. But
that's
you
okay.
Know,
it threatens them is what it does.
Yeah,
we can look at objects, we can hear stories of objects being sighted, but when you start hearing people talk about, well, yes, they spoke to me, then it gets a little loopy. But that's okay. If it's reality, it's reality, and people are going to have to make do with what they have. So.
Well, you know, you can't be responsible for other people's
No, no, you just tell it like it is. That's what Howard Cosell told me many years ago. He said, he did. He said, no matter what the price, no matter what the cost, he said, Jeff, you've always got to tell it exactly like it really is.
Oh, yeah.
Good for him.
He did. All right.
Good for Howard.
Let's pause and wish I could do his voice. We'll be back in just a couple minutes with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. Remember, tomorrow night, Friday, December the 12th on the Sci-Fi Channel. 9 Eastern, 8 Central. And you're going to see an amazing documentary hosted by Bryant Gumbel. Okay, Larry Warren, let's go ahead. We have one segment left.
I think basically the program will get into what I witnessed with Charles Holm, you know, the other participants in this thing. Another thing that they get into is, you know, the mind control elements of this, which is people might find even very disturbing. But like Charles
Holm... You know, Larry, excuse me, Larry, but our own government is doing mind control right now on us, on all sorts of different advanced electronic frontiers and platforms. They're looking even for the buy indicator, buy center of the brain, so they can trigger that and make people buy things. It's all happening, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that an advanced civilization or intelligence would be able to do this with ease.
Yeah, but it was I'm talking about our government doing it, and in the aftermath of these events,
sure.
And like Charles Holt said that, and his position is, I haven't spoken to him in a number of years, but that myself and others were meddled with, and he was out of the heat. They didn't get at him because he knew people in powerful places. I'm sure he does. I wish I did back then. But the point I try to make is that all that began with the intelligence community after the fact, and they apparently can do this with hypnosis and narcotics. And what they may have done, you know, there's elements in our book where I think just a light read of it, you would think, yeah, he thinks there's aliens that live under Bentwaters base. If you read the whole book carefully, you find out that probably isn't the case, but someone really wanted myself and probably others to infuse very bizarre elements that no one would believe at all, thus destroying the case. I was very honest in that book to the point of, you know, talking about things that most people don't talk about in a book about their personal life. But, you know, my family had to read it, and they'd be the first one to say BS if it was, you know, I was. If I was lying, they'd know it first. But the main thing is that they went to such levels with this, and I concur with Charles Holt, that, and I know when it happened to me, is that, and others, where they did scramble around things and put imagery into the mind that was so... And let me tell you, if they didn't do that, then the invasion's over. I mean, we're run by somebody else. And I mean, there's two variances here. But I always say that happened to me after the fact. My recollection of those events, as far as I know, is as accurate as I can be. And I've been as truthful as I can be. I believe what I'm saying. I don't know what it is that I saw. But the human rights violations that happened here, and I hope this program, obviously you have the advantage of having seen it, does deal, and it is not just me that had things...
talk about it, and they show those doing the, shall we say, interrogations, holding up hypodermic syringes.
Well, it was done in a surgical setting, and it... But there was imagery that turned it all into complete science fiction. Of course, I wrote it as I lived it at that time, or as I believed I lived it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how serious they can get at it, because I would have been predisposed in a psychological profile to be a whistleblower, apparently. Now, they knew they couldn't contain this, and they didn't contain it. The cover-up didn't work. But Charles Holt, of course, authored that memo. I wrote a letter to my mother days before he authored that. Basically, it reads just like the Holt memo before he wrote it, but I was minimalizing events because I knew they'd read the mail, trying to fill in the blanks. I think that's what this poor guy had to do, and, you know, crap rolls downhill, and he was the guy he had to roll to. These guys have pensions. They were career Air Force people, military people, and I can respect that and do, but they still, as far as I know, cannot fully say what went on there. They can't even say we had nuclear weapons. And I think it's time they had immunity and were able to go forward, not worried about losing their hard-earned pensions. I don't have a pension. I was just an airman first class, and I was a guy that just had this conscious thing that I had to simply... Look, you know, enough is enough. Enough people that see this stuff worldwide have been ridiculed and goofed around with by governments, particularly ours. Here in Britain, they try to weasel out of it saying, well, there was no cover-up. It, bull. There was. and they're in it together. But it's a very small thing that runs and controls this phenomenon. I don't think it's the government at large that's transitioning.
Well, you folks see the documentary tomorrow night with some remarkable people involved in it. They got Lord, what's
Hill
his
Norton.
Full? I don't want to leave anything out. I know it's Lord Hill Norton. Is there anything else in his title that we should mention?
Well, Lord Admiral Peter Hill Norton, former Chief of Staff of the Ministry of Defense.
Yeah, I didn't have it all.
He always gets mad at Peter for titling him that way. It's Admiral of the Fleet, Peter Hill Norton.
Okay, anyway, when you see this, it's as if in the documentary they made the point that if Colin Powell were to sit down and do a documentary and just think of Colin Powell or Secretary of State or someone at that level when you see Lord Hill Norton talking about this in the documentary tomorrow night. It's just extraordinary, indeed.
That's absolutely correct. He would be the full equivalent of Colin Powell. Retired.
Yeah, and then some. All right, now we've got just about 5-6 minutes left. Larry, we don't want to leave everyone completely dangling with this issue. What happened in the field in just about 2 minutes, and just give us a quick synopsis of the report.
Okay, well, basically this object came in. It transformed via an explosion of some sort that caused retinal burns to my eyes. I have to say a lot of folks that were around the phenomena suffered adverse health effects as exposed to an unshielded nuclear device. I'm one of them. This is all documented. I know people have had problems. There's a lot of different physical and human issues that came from exposure to this stuff with a number of the witnesses. And it's basically the long and short of it is that there was an encounter with what I believe, I've never said alien, it was alien to me, non-human beings or creatures, or it was some amazing special effects, but this was 1980, folks, and I this is what I saw. It is not what I initially, you know, you've heard through the years I changed my story and all this nonsense. Well, other authors have changed my story. What I did when I came out is that, you know, in 1982, and it was quite by accident, you know, you just don't talk about seeing the living part of it. You know, there were beings or there was something there. So I just said I passed out or whatever. It was a lot easier for me. I said, you get other people to confirm this and then I'll go further.
That's thoroughly understandable. All right,
well,
what happened to the craft itself? How did it disappear or take off?
I don't know, because I was there for the time I was, probably 30 minutes, and our senior, our flight chief actually started pulling us off and away from the site and sent us back. And when I walked away, there were a number of personnel were still in conjunction with this object on the ground.
Meaning?
Facing off with it, and there was also the three entities or whatever.
Still out.
That was still there because I looked over my left shoulder and there it was. But again, movement, you're in shock at this point. Like, my God, I mean, the world changed that night. If this has never happened before, it happened in late December 1980. And these things were there for a reason. And something very heavy went on. These things definitely showed themselves. There was a display of their abilities.
Yeah.
Even the Hall tape demonstrates that. This was real, folks. I've been saying it for 23 years. This is the one with teeth. You can take it into a courtroom. You can subpoena people. And I'll tell you what, we'd win in front of any jury in the world that this stuff went down.
Okay. Peter Robbins, the other concept of lights from above shining down onto the storage bunkers where the nuclear warheads were kept?
Yes. Yes, the lights that, well, what would look to us now like a modern laser pointer, but again, this is not the technology available at the time, but these beams of light were visible in part because it was misty and it saw straight down. But we had it confirmed to us directly by Charles Holt when we met him finally after some years in a meeting directly across the street from the Pentagon in a shopping mall there, that those beams of light adversely affected the ordnance, and that chilling bit of militarese essentially means that these beams of light somehow penetrated down through these hardened bunkers under which, well under which, was the nuclear ordnance, bunkers made of alternating layers of steel, of concrete, of earth. It got, these beams of light got through and affected the nuclear munitions, obviously, did not affect them in a
incendiary way.
We can only assume, because Mr. Holt did not go into particulars, that it shut these things down.
Well, he didn't say nuclear either at all, because he can't. And again, that comes down to
nor did he in the documentary.
No, and because he can't, and I understand that. You know, I mean, this guy would probably like to say a heck of a lot more than he currently is allowed to. You know, the system, he's had to become the most senior guy that speaks about it, and there's people above him that might know more than him, but they've been protected, you know. They've been the sacred cows of all this, and then it goes even higher. And I don't think it's fair for him. I wish he had been on the program tonight. Just, you know,
yes.
Occasionally tries to avoid me. There's no need to. I'm on his side for sure. And, you know, if I was meddled with like everyone else, you know, I think we all should be in it together, because it's all part of a big picture and we're on the same team.
I think you need not worry about that. It's quite clear when you watch the program that Lieutenant Colonel, he is the Deputy Base Commander, Charles Holt, is clearly in possession of other knowledge and is doing his best to stay within the bounds he's been given. I think there'll be an awful lot of people watching this tomorrow night from the military, from other branches of our paid representatives, who will be very interested to watch and see just how much makes it to the screen. And there's obviously quite a bit more. Let me thank Larry Warren first, Peter. Thank you, Larry. It's great to talk with you again. I want to salute you for your courage, your integrity, for standing up for so many years to this, and you sound just great.
Well, Jeff, you know, thanks a lot. I'm a dad late in life, and my son, Sir Dennis, there, we call him Peter's Uncle Peter. I do it all again, because it all led me to a wonderful little boy, and I will set an example for him. This will be his future, his reality, his generation. I hope we all, and I
great.
Think all us witnesses at Bentwaters will contribute to that in a positive
wonderful
way. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Larry. And Peter Robbins, my friend, always a pleasure. You're a real credit to the whole field, and I'm glad to have had the opportunity to spend some time with you tonight.
And always good speaking with you, Jeff.
Thank you. All right, we'll all be watching tomorrow night. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.